if I'm pharma and I'm developing protocols for the US market and I've got the market on tap there, why on earth should I bother trying to come to the UK?
In terms of if you want to come and test your new drug and you want to work with great academic institutions that are here, great NHS organisations with a good track record of delivering high quality research, the UK's a no-brainer.
This is clearly something that can be done to help with clinical trials to make them smoother. Hi, my name is Tina Marshall and welcome to our podcast. Today I have with me Mike Senever-Ratner from RDASH, which is Rotherham, Doncaster and South Humber. Mike is here today to talk from the research director's perspective with regards to mental health research, how it's managed, things that we can do to help, and things that also our pharma partners can do to help. So thank you very much for coming in today. It's really a pleasure to have you here. So first of all, let's dig into what on earth is going on in the research landscape. So we know from our perspective that a lot of pharma companies are trying to move away from the UK because they say it's just too difficult to recruit patients and too difficult to have trials. Whereas we also know that, of course, the local pharma really want to have trials here. And we know that from the government perspective, you know, and George Freeman, we're trying really hard to make the UK become a life sciences superpower, super hub. So from your perspective, why is it so hard to run a clinical trial in the UK?
Wow. I mean, that's a big question to open with. But multiple reasons. There's no one easy answer to this, but thinking about recruitment particularly, the NHS as a whole organisation has very, very limited resources and they've been kind of chipped away at over the years. And trying to, you know, clinical work in itself is difficult enough. And I think there's lots and lots of very, very busy clinicians who would love to be doing research. I mean, the amount of clinicians that we've got, even in RDASH, who want to be doing research, but struggle to get the time to do it because the clinical work
it's so overwhelming
and we're, you know, we've got too few clinicians, you know, there's far too few nurses, far too few doctors working in our services, so they're trying to do the job of multiple people as well. And I think it's a bit of a, you know, perfect storm really, for meaning that research kind of gets pushed to the side, even though I think deep down people do know that research is the way to, you know, to develop new technology, new therapies for patients.
Do you think that it's kind of seen as a nice to have on the ground?
Yeah, I think that view has changed a little bit because of COVID, because I think that did help to get people thinking, oh, actually, you know, research is going to save us here. And it did. And people have kind of recognised that. And the massive, you know, response to the call outs for COVID vaccine participants, you know, is good evidence of that. But yeah, I think there are still quite a lot of clinicians and hospital managers who think, oh, that's nice for, you know, other people to be doing, and we'll just watch and see what happens. It you know, as I say, I think any time if you spend any time with a clinician or manager to really explain things, they get it and they want to be doing it. And as I say, I have got people thankfully knocking at the door saying, please, can we do some research? It's fantastic. But then freeing up their time
to do that. That's a different matter, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So so we've got the issue for the clinician's time. So how do you think we'll actually be able to bridge that gap? Because that's not going to go away. So how can we become this life sciences superpower with the pressure on the clinicians, because there still will and always will be that pressure on the clinicians, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I suppose it's about doing things maybe a little bit differently. And so, you know, are there technologies that we can use that can cut out some of that, you know, of the pipeline that you undertake when you take on a research project? Like, are there bits that we can, like participant identification, for example, you know, and that's where something like Acrivia is really, really useful, because it can show you the participants that are likely to be eligible for a study. And then that cuts down a huge amount of clinician time going through their caseload, thinking, oh, yes, that person might be eligible, that one might not, having to look through records to do that.
So typically they would have to do it kind of like by hand and...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. There isn't... I mean, yes, there's reporting systems, but they're fairly crude. And certainly in mental health services, not that many patients have a hard-coded diagnosis. You know, you'd have to trawl through the notes to find what the diagnosis
is.
That's
very time-consuming.
It's incredibly time-consuming when you've got caseloads of thousands of patients, yeah. and it's just it's not feasible. You know, that's a full-time job for somebody just yeah. doing that. And if they're trying to, at the same time, see those patients and provide that care, it can't be done.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one aspect. What other aspects could...
So other parts
could be sped up.
Yeah, so again, thinking about what takes time with these things. So the thinking about the very beginning of deploying a new study, training mm-hmm. is a good example. So we were kind of on the journey for signing up for a study, and the training was going to take at least 2 full days of online videos. I had to block off. I actually did block off Ouch. That time in my diary to just sit and watch these videos. And it was very, very, very dull, to the point that actually how much of it's really going in? Probably very little. And I'd be referring to
yeah.
the manuals afterwards.
But then if I'm being devil's advocate, what would happen if they didn't provide the 2 full days of training?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was self-paced, which was good. So you could kind of do it in drips and drabs, but I just felt I needed to do it that way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you need to know what you're doing with a study. You have to be able to deliver a study safely and scientifically, yeah. You know, rigorously. So absolutely appropriate. But I think there's certain things where maybe...
So I guess, was it all appropriate? Or was it not appropriate? Was it all necessary?
I wouldn't say it was all completely necessary. And I think it would be necessary to see that for the complete study, but there'll be certain people doing certain aspects of the study where that, you know, certain bits of the training are relevant. For example, you know, how to ship lab samples. It's not something I'm going to be doing, but, you know, I, as a PI, I needed to look at all of these mm-hmm. videos so that I had an awareness of it, which again makes sense because if I'm taking responsibility yeah. for the conduct of the study, but there's an element of, I trust my colleagues to do their jobs properly. So I trust that if they were to watch those videos and do that training, I trust that they've done that. And, yeah. and if there were issues, well, that's what you've got a CRO there to help you, who's monitoring what you're doing, and you have monitoring yeah. visits checking that everything's being done properly. So I think there is, there's never going to be a perfect solution to cutting out all training, but I think it could be done more smartly. In addition, I do think, are there kind of training passports that you could create? And I know there are some of these do exist, and certainly within drug companies, you've got alliances with certain CROs as well. There's certain training that kind of stays on a log, and that's fine. But having like a bit of a passport for, you know, I've done my whatever assessment training, you know, if it's like a PANS scoring, I've done my PANS scoring, that's fine, done. You know, there could be other examples like that, especially if you're using, if there's kind of similar... Going back to the lab processing samples thing.
So that's really interesting. Things. Because in kind of like your standard typical corporate world, there would be a record of all of the training that you've done.
Oh, there is for the NHS. I've got my mandatory training. But there isn't... as I say, I'm aware there are some attempts to do that for research. None that I've been able to... For any of the research projects we've done, they've not had that. So it's something that definitely could be... You know, if all the big pharma companies, for example, got together and say, okay, we will accept... this training program, and if people have done it, uploaded their certificates to like an online portal or something, it's how it works with the NHS. I've got my mandatory e-learning that you go through, and it just stays on your record, and then, you know, you don't have to repeat it until mm-hmm. it goes out of date. Perfect.
I think that's a great idea, and this is a call out for pharma who are watching this from Mike and I to develop something like this. So one of the questions that I've had before is, you know, can we find out from our NHS what can be done to help them with clinical trials to make it much smoother? This is clearly something that can be done to help with clinical trials to make them smoother in the UK. I think that's a really great idea. Do you have any others? Like, what else are the real blockers with the clinical trials? So the training is one. We need to slim that down so that we don't have 2 days of training for something that you might not need to do. Let's make it relevant to the relevant people.
And also just, you know, not just making it relevant to the relevant people, but trying to trim down some of what's in there as well, because, you know, some of these videos are very, very long, and it feels like they're just ticking a box themselves to say they've delivered that tick, done, they're covered from their interim.
And sometimes as marketers, you know, you do go on and on a bit.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And we've touched on participant recruitment as well, mm-hmm. and the difficulties of identifying participants. But then I suppose when it comes to running the study and having things you know, you've opened the study, got your first patient in. And then one of the things that we have struggled with in the past, but it's entirely variable, is the CRO. We've worked with some fantastic CROs and we've worked with some terrible CROs. And that can make a huge difference to team morale. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because feeling supported by your CRO, you know, having that good responsive communication is really essential. So that I know, you know, we've just done a COVID vaccine study and it's obviously ongoing, but all the recruitment's ended now. Mm-hmm. The CRO was brilliant. Really, really helpful. Really responsive. If we had a quick question, bam, they would, you know, yep, get back to us the same day or the next day at the latest. And it felt collaborative and it worked well. And funnily enough, recruitment went really well and it was a great study. Obviously, the ongoing bit's still ongoing, but no problems. And we've had no issues mm-hmm. from the CRO, no major issues with our site because we've had that collaboration to begin yep. with to get it right in the beginning. It can be really tricky when you don't have that responsiveness because it might be that you're maybe not doing something quite right, but because you don't know that you're not doing it quite right.
You don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. And so it carries on.
And then if somebody isn't responding to you or if somebody's responding in a difficult way, why do you want to help them?
Well, exactly, exactly. But then equally, it comes down to human nature,
doesn't it?
Exactly. And then mm-hmm. when it comes to the data cleansing at the end and they realise, oh, hang on a minute, I need to go back and redo all of this and get the participants back in to redo a certain bit because it wasn't done in maybe quite the right way. It's just, you know, it's time consuming. It's annoying for the participants having mm-hmm. to bring them back in sometimes for doing bits. And it's entirely avoidable. You know, there'll always be bits that go wrong in studies, but if you really put that groundwork in at the beginning and have that yeah. good communication, you're going to eliminate 90% of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got a couple of really good tangible things there. And one is the training and a really nice training platform with a joint certification. Like we have for so many different things, but we need to have it for the research landscape. Then another is the really good relationship with the CROs. That's absolutely key. What else is it that you think that pharma specifically could do to help you with a clinical trial? So when you get a protocol, how does that feel, that process when you're looking at it?
Yeah, so they're very American focused and the protocols are often, you know, it's you read them, you go, okay, yes, this makes sense in America, but maybe not here. Mm-hmm. And we have to kind of do a bit of mental juggling to see, yeah. okay, how does this fit in with A, our clinical services, and B, just our processes for research as well, because there's obviously quite a big difference. So having UK-focused protocols would be really helpful. I know that the UK is a diminishing market for pharma companies, but something like that would be really helpful and hopefully wouldn't be too much legwork from their end to make
to change it over.
Yeah, and part of that could involve actually coming and, you know, talking to services, doing some really good PPIE work. Come and talk to us. How does like mental health care get delivered in the UK? How do mm-hmm. early intervention clinics work? What's the flow through of patients? I actually had somebody from one of the drug companies recently get in touch to go through exactly that. You
nice.
Know, and it was really lovely because you could see they want to deliver.
They really want to understand more.
Exactly. They want to understand how does it work? How can we therefore, because they have a huge role in developing new therapeutic processes yeah. as well as drugs themselves, but the process around that drug, especially in mental health, where it's not going to be just one drug, it's going to be a drug maybe alongside a therapy at the same
yeah,
time.
Absolutely.
So they're going to really kind of drive that process forward and having them engage and say, how does it work already? Really helpful.
So so tell me then, and again, I'm going to put myself into the devil's advocate hat. If I'm pharma and I'm developing protocols for the US market and I've got the market on tap there, why on earth should I bother trying to come to the UK?
Yeah, and I can see what they feel and why they mean that, because certainly it does seem to be the research landscape is tailing off a little bit in the UK, but it's still a really, you know, it's a world leader in healthcare still, the UK, and in terms of our position with the data that we collect, because, you know, again, with most trusts now being, and certainly in mental health, being on electronic records, we've got rich data sources now as well for doing A, the participant identification, mm-hmm. etc., but also the longer term follow-up, you know, looking at actually the medications being prescribed, what's the real world outcome of that, and doing that like proper real world research post-market stuff is ideal.
And that's where the NHS number is a real nugget,
isn't it? Brilliant. You've got a unique identifier that follows you from birth to death. It's mm-hmm. amazing. It's really unique as a resource to have that. And again, then when you have solutions like Acrivia being able to offer that service free of charge to the NHS as well, which is fantastic. So we can do like loads of really fascinating
and
research.
And I also haven't told him to say that.
No, but it is. It's an amazing resource. Like, you know, and I think the UK is starting to wake up to the data side of things as well with the development of the national SDE and subnational SDEs. But it's
so let me ask you then. So do you think that actually they're missing a trick by not coming to the UK?
I think so, because we're still a really, like, you know, we want to do the research.
Because they're developing medications without having the true understanding of the patient's history and exactly. the long-term outcomes.
Yeah, we've got all of that data. We've got very, very well-developed and well-understood clinical pathways. We've got, like, NICE that say this is how you should deliver mm-hmm. care for this particular condition across the country. It's, like, universally designed. Well, it's designed to be as universal as possible. So, yeah, I would say that it's in terms of if you want to come and test your new drug and you want to work with great academic institutions that are here, great NHS organisations with a good track record of delivering high quality research, mm-hmm. the UK's a no-brainer. It just needs to get its act together when it comes to doing more.
Yeah. And I think that that's where the entire ecosystem is really important, because it's not just the NHS alone. You know, it's all of the providers and the life sciences community.
Yes.
Because as you've said, you know, right at the very beginning, if there's a way that we can speed up training to make sure that it's relevant to each particular person and to streamline that whole process, and that's something that pharma can absolutely help with, then that will help the NHS, mm-hmm. which again could drive more value. Let me ask you about patients and their involvement in clinical trials. How do you think patients feel about being involved in clinical trials?
It's a mixed bag, and there's huge differences between different groups of people as well. And it's a shame that still your typical research participant is white, middle class, university educated, mm-hmm. and that's missing a huge amount of society, and particularly a huge amount of society that have a greater burden of disease. You know, so COVID again really highlighted this when it came to the vaccine rollout, that there's a lot of suspicion around organisations and big, you know, the man, as it were, you know, the government, the NHS, yeah. trying to inject me with something, you know. And there's lots of suspicion there, very understandably, given some historical issues. But yeah, what you need, you know, that's why it's really important to engage everybody. And I think that's something that Ardash, we're quite good at. We've got very well engaged patient research ambassadors mm-hmm. Who've been brilliant in helping us access. I hate the term hard to reach, because I think that puts the onus on other people. It's people we fail to reach, communities. And for the likes of prison, like Doncaster's got 5 prisons. And
I did not know that.
Yeah, and again, prisoners are a massively under-researched area. Thankfully, yeah. that's something we're trying to address. And there's networks like the Porsche Network that try and address that. But again, a lot more could be done. Things like the Emory Network, again, mm-hmm. try to address that. And that's fantastic. And I think it is slowly but surely going to change, but it's going to be a long process. It's not a quick, you can't change that overnight. That's something that you have to actually sit down with people, discuss research, discuss why it's important, discuss, you know, how it could help them and their yep. communities, and that you have to put the legwork in to do it. But drug companies can do that as well. I mean, we do that as an organization, but drug companies can do that when designing studies. PPIE is obviously very well developed here in the UK, probably more so than many other places, actually.
So just to clarify for everybody what PPIE is.
So it's patient participant involvement and engagement.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah.
So that's so key. Like, if you're designing studies with the participants that you want to be involved, you're going to design a study that they then want to get involved in. It's a no-brainer.
So when you say design them with, do you mean that they should actually physically have a meeting with them? And
Yeah. Well, that's the ideal. I know that that's not always very practical, but then talk to the organisations that do this.
Yeah.
So again, we've got a strong PPIE engagement team at Ardash. That's come and talk to us, and we'll help you talk to people. Or we can take questions on your behalf and talk to the people that we know. That's, you know, it's so key, because designing studies to work for the participants that's one of the biggest barriers when it comes to recruitment, is that mm-hmm. it's a lot of effort for people to get involved. And we're asking, especially in today's climate of cost of living crisis, we've got ongoing problems from Brexit and COVID still, you know, loads and loads of difficulties and loads of pressure on people's lives. And then if these people are also suffering with their mental health at the same time, like we were talking about with staff earlier, you know, in terms of how have they got the mental capacity or physical capacity to engage in research as well? And it's just, we're asking a lot of them to do this. And it's no surprise then that a lot turn around and go, not interested in the study.
Too much to cope with.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So if you design a study to make it as easy as possible to be a participant in, your recruitment is going to be better.
So when we're talking about patients and the economy and the pressures on everybody, how many of the studies take place where they could go to in the evening or the weekend?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. And what we're seeing is the rise of lots of private research sites, aren't we, who often do that. Now, evening and weekends, it's something, again, as an NHS organisation, I'd love to be able to offer that. But then you've got to find the staff for that and, you know, and you've got to match that. So, yes, I'd love to be able to do that and make it as convenient as possible. And, you know, fine, we'll work a little bit late into the evening to try and do that. But you can't, you can't ask that of staff without then...
No, not when they're already under a huge amount of pressure.
So it's difficult. But, yeah, that would be ideal, you know, people doing it in people's homes. But I think it's not just necessarily about the timings. There's ways of doing things, like, a little bit more cleverly. So... remote assessments, doing more remote assessments, remote capacity consenting, which it does get used in some studies, but we could do more of that.
Yeah.
So maybe some more of the kind of like asynchronous assessments as well. So instead of having bloods and this assessment, maybe you could also do it where you have the assessment then the bloods and just try and work it around.
Yeah.
There'll be limits to that in terms of making sure the scientific quality of the study is still there. But where you can, allow flexibility. You know, protocol says you have to see this person within a window of 2 days for follow-up. Yeah, in 6 months' time. Ah, come on, they might be on holiday, you know. And then it's protocol really deviation difficult. If you see them outside of that. It's like, well, come on, we're just being practical. So I think there's an element of realism that needs to come into that as well. I get that there's complete scientific quality that needs to remain, and otherwise what's the point of doing the research? But I think we're a little bit too far in that this has to be done in this incredibly rigid way.
It's too rigid.
Yeah, yeah. And it'll be different for different studies, but yeah.
It's been really, actually really interesting and enlightening speaking to Mike today to understand more about what can be done from an NHS perspective, because we always talk about and we always hear that pharma are moving away from the UK because it's so difficult, but what can actually be done to help move those clinical trials into the UK? And as we've talked about, and as we are all really aware, the unique identifier of having the NHS number is what truly will make the NHS the superpower, because there's nowhere else that gives that cradle-to-grave information. It's just so unique and so powerful. And there are a couple of real nuggets that Mike talked about that can genuinely help with research in the UK. Always at the forefront. And as we've been talking about in many of our podcasts, we've been talking about putting the patient first. So, Mike, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. And I know we'll do more of these to come.
Great. Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.